initial argument is this, the way in which we interpret a resolution. We have a topic. Most people believe we debate this topic. There's language for that topic, and that's what we're going to debate. And this is a single, unitary construction. Everyone looks at it, oh, it's obvious what we're going to debate. And so this is the point of debate, and we have a government who's going to debate one side of this topic, and an opposition that will debate the other side of this topic. I disagree. And the reason that I disagree is that we don't have a single topic. This presumes that there is a universal knowing about any topic with which you're presented. But instead of having a single, unitary topic, I believe we have multiple topics. And we have one lexical construction, one set of key terms that we use to debate, but people view this differently. And the reason is because you're different people. You have different identities, different histories, different knowledge bases. And so when you look at the same words, it means different things to you. When we have any topic, we actually have multiple possibilities for the government, which now requires multiple points of resistance for the opposition. And it's not that I think that one should artificially manipulate the language of a topic to give one a strategic advantage. This is the way in which language functions. Language is indeterminate. It's the way in which we understand the world. We don't all understand the world in the same way. So one person might look at a topic on the death penalty, and their reaction is, I want to focus on the issue of capital crimes and the people that are in prison on death row. And so my understanding of abolition of the death penalty is to say, let's stop executing criminals who've been convicted of special circumstances crimes. Someone else looks at a topic for abolition of the death penalty, and the first thing that comes to mind is, I want to stop the testing of animals by cosmetic and drug companies. This is as surely an execution as goes on anywhere else. There's torture prior to the execution as well. And that's the first thing that pops into their mind. Why would one presume that one is correct and one is incorrect? Only based on the biases that one brings by one's own knowledge and identification. And so if you appreciate that people are different and can understand the world differently from you, there's no reason to impose your judgment. Everyone must talk about this from a universal standpoint, defining yourself as the universal knowing. I mean, that seems to me to be arrogant more than appreciative of the differences that exist in the world. So the way in which I understand the world of parliamentary debate is to say, yes, we are given a single topic, but it's subject to multiple interpretations. And we also know something else about interpretations in parliamentary debate. We know that we get different topics each round. And this is what I think you need to avoid. You need to avoid being ruled by the topic. You cannot be ruled by the topic. You must rule the topics. You have to control the world of the topics. There are debaters who will say, you know, I had a great round this last round. It was about an economics topic. I'm an economics major. I knew a lot about the issues. And so I was really wildly successful. But that second round, I don't know anything about philosophy. I haven't taken any philosophy classes. So I didn't know anything about that. But I hope this next round, there will be a topic that matches my knowledge. If you debate like that, your debate will be like this wild roller coaster ride in which you sometimes have the thrill of matching your knowledge base to the topic, and other times you won't have any knowledge about the topic and your opponents will. Well, this seems to me to be a prescription for winning and losing debates on an almost random basis, and you'll be lucky to be 3-3 in preliminary debates in a tournament. In fact, all of your debates should be here. How do you do that? How do you guarantee that in a world with multiple topics, you saw the topic list that I have available for you, there are hundreds of topics on that list that were gathered from tournaments in the Western United States and some international tournaments, but primarily from tournaments in the Western United States over only about an 18-month period. And so there are hundreds of topics that you could debate, and in any given round you could debate multiple interpretations. How will you control debate when you're debating the infinite? Well, we know in practice you're not debating the infinite. The topics recur, I don't want to say that tournament directors are slovenly about the way in which they select topics, but quite frequently they just look at headlines for the last couple of weeks and throw together some topics for a tournament, presuming that your preparation is all about reading current events. And if anyone has experience debating in particular areas of the country, they know that they will debate issues like the death penalty several times during the year, that the topics recur with some frequency. And so it's not that you debate the infinite, but there is a broad range of argumentation that exists in parliamentary debate. You need to be able to cope with it. Here are coping strategies. I think you need to focus on the underlying assumptions of the case. Let me begin with a definition as to what I believe the government's trying to do in any debate. They are trying to establish a formal hypothesis that's justifiably affirmable if and only if a certain set of facts obtains. This is what is happening when the government is making its presentation in the debate. They have created a case that is a formal hypothesis that is justifiably affirmable if and only if a certain set of facts obtains. And so they create a fact set for you to understand that they are meeting their burden of proof in the debate. Some set of material conditions to prove the legitimacy of their case, to demonstrate that the resolution is more likely to be true than it is to be false. And in establishing that burden of proof, they will make the following claims. They will make, these claims that they will be implicit or explicit. They will make some value claims, something about the issue of the good, because otherwise, why would you pay attention to someone if they weren't selling something to you that would be something that happened to be good? This will be couched with particular language. And so there are some rhetorical devices that they will use. That's also an assumption of their advocacy in a debate. There will be some policy assumptions, again, explicit or implicit. And they will also want you to consider their idea exclusively, which means that another assumption of the case will be the absence of alternatives. And it seems to me that these are the core assumptions associated with a case presentation. To meet one's burden of proof, they will talk about the good in a particular way, and they will have some assumptions about policy issues, and these might be explicit ones, a case that says, let's take a particular policy action. Or they might express some value, I stand here in front of you, in favor of the issue of free speech, that certainly has some assumptions about what policies are consistent with the idea of free speech, and also that there is a singular, exclusive presentation. You've got to listen to the speaker, you've got to listen to the government's presentation, because there aren't reasonable alternatives to it. There aren't competing alternatives. These are the assumptions associated with the case. This is how you identify the points of attack that are available to you when you're on the opposition. So, before I begin, let me mention one thing about the nature of refutation. I'm going to give you four elements associated with refutation for the debate. You can attack your opponent's arguments in any of these four ways. First, you can establish that the issue is irrelevant. If the issue is irrelevant, the government's issue is irrelevant in the discussion, there's no reason to respond to it. Give me an example of where a very popular argument in which you try to establish the irrelevance of the government's position.
A popular argument?
Yeah, one that's used quite commonly. That's slightly different. I'll mention that in a minute. Topicality arguments.
The only thing I think of is we were thinking last night if they'd run, they'd actually run, we want to change the song, that was going to be our main point of attack. Hey, look, who cares about the.
Again, I want to make a distinction between that and the next thing that I'll talk about. But here, I'm literally talking about irrelevance. The issues that are raised by the government are not germane to the resolution. And so a topicality argument might be one that says, here's an interpretation, doesn't connect with the topic. There is no reason for us to answer an argument that is not germane to the question. Second one, and I think this is the one that Don and Annie are talking about, and this one is minimization. Minimization. That the argument advanced by your opponent is trivial. It's of little consequence. It is not substantial. It is insignificant. And this is a second way of arguing an issue. Third, you can turn an argument. And to turn an argument, you're literally making the claim that the government believes that an issue sits on their side of the question. Wrong. The issue actually sits on your side of the question. That the argument that they presented, the fact set that's available, is a superior argument for the opposition than it is for the government. Finally, if you are unable to render their argument irrelevant, if their argument is substantial and must be addressed, and there's no way to capture the argument for your side of the question, only then should you answer the argument. I think most people reverse this, and they think that every argument requires an answer. And in fact, that's the least efficient way of addressing your opponent's presentations in a debate. Here, you don't even have to answer their argument. You're simply saying, regardless of the merit of their argument, it's not part of the question. And so there is no reason to even sustain a discussion about it. Here, you're arguing that it doesn't matter what they've said. Their argument is so insubstantial that it is of little consequence. And again, does it require an answer? Here, you're capturing their argument. Wonderful idea. It's better for us, though, than it is for you. And so these arguments are quite efficient. You do not have to create a burden of proof in your presentation. There is no fact set that you have to generate. You don't have to use evidence from your own experience in order to sustain these arguments. And so these are efficient. Now, you're going to debate sophisticated debaters. They're going to make arguments that are relevant, that are substantial, and are incapable of being turned. It doesn't mean that you won't have to answer arguments. You will, but it should be your last resort. And here, what you're trying to do is make sure that if you have to raise your own fact set, establish your own burden of proof, that you do this as a last resort. After you've taken advantage of all these other opportunities for refutation. Yes, Sean?
I think by answer you mean like where you actually try to negate the truth of the of
correct.
The okay, because all those other ones seem like answers to me, but then I see the fourth one that means actually try to say
where you establish, you have to establish your own burdens, yeah. Establish your own reasoning and evidence and match the fact set that they presented in the discussion. All right, so now let's get back to evaluating these issues. And I want to begin by talking about value comparisons and hierarchies. I think there are a core set of values that you can debate in any presentation. There are obviously different expressions of these, but and I recognize that at their heart, each one of these encompasses all of the others. You can't extract and identify one value in such a way that it is so distinct that the other ones aren't implicated, but let me give you a half dozen that I think have sufficient distinction so that you could argue about them. Life, liberty, equality, justice, privacy, and aesthetics. Life, liberty, equality, justice, privacy, and aesthetics. These are not easy issues to debate. We don't have shared assumptions about many of these issues. We view these issues in a dramatically different way. They are super symbolic terms. They're loaded. Many of these issues have been debated for thousands of years in very different cultural settings. And so they're loaded terms. There's a lot of stuff in there. And it's difficult to unpack. It's difficult to interpret these. And we have problems associated with debate. It's hard to debate some of these complex issues, some for obvious reasons. Well, we don't have enough time in the speeches that we're given in a debate to adequately address some of these issues. And after all, we're not really truth-seeking in debates, despite what debaters say. Well, we're trying to find the truth here. That's not accurate. Debaters are advantage-seeking. They are not truth-seeking. They are trying to establish a position relative to their opponent's position that demonstrates that at a point in time, their analysis about an issue is superior. But they are advantage-seeking, not truth-seeking. Certainly not truth-seeking this way. Truth with a capital T. Big truth. Understanding some sort of universal objective approach to our lives. And so these issues are difficult, but I think that it's possible to still debate these issues, and I want to give you some ways in which you can effectively debate value constructions in a debate. Now, these are always there. They are there as the underlying assumptions of claims that people make, even if they're not explicit. Here are ways in which you can evaluate them. First, you can evaluate them for consistency. For consistency. Does the case support the value claim? Does the case support the value claim? I'll talk more about this later when I talk about value and criterial issues. But they have to sustain in argument a value claim that they make throughout an entire presentation. Secondly, you can argue against the value. You can argue against the value. You can argue against the value in either its absolutist or its qualified expression. The example that I will give you is the example of liberty. People will say I'm in favor of liberty. I think we can agree that we are all in favor of freedom. I want to be free to remove all your money from you. How do you feel about my expression of freedom? Agree with me?
I don't know.
You do? Come bring it forward.
I think I have the freedom to pursue. The fleecing of my money.
No, I'm not fleecing your money. I want the freedom to just have it. And so the issue is you might resist that.
Right.
And then people say what in a debate? That one's expression of freedom stops when it reaches other people. You know, the expression about how your fist stops when it reaches someone else's nose. Yes.
Wouldn't that be a good time to make the distinction between liberty and license?
You might make the distinction between liberty and license. Yes. But the issue might be a qualified, this is the way in which one qualifies an expression of liberty. And so what is it, what does it mean to qualify an expression of liberty? What does it mean if one's freedom to act has to be checked when it reaches other people? Are there any freedoms left? We live in social communities. We interact with each other all the time. One's behavior necessarily affects other people. If I'm speaking, someone else is not. If I take a job, someone else doesn't have that job. If I get a high score on an exam that's graded on a curve, other people necessarily receive a lower score on that exam. One's behavior is always interacting with the behavior of others. Well, if you say, I'm only in favor of a freedom, an understanding of freedom, that stops based on any reaction that you might have to my expression, then all my behavior is checked. And so what kind of freedom is the government in favor of? Well, they're not in favor of an absolutist freedom, nor are they in favor of a qualified freedom. They've said that they're in favor of freedom, but they sound like friendly fascists. They're only in favor of a kind of freedom that no one gets. And so this is a way that you can argue against a particular value. You can also argue against the value construct itself by making the claim that there is no value there. And an example might be equality. Equality is entirely dependent, one might argue, on the existence of other values. It only is a distributional means. It says how much of a share of something else that someone gets. If we have something, if we pool all our money, and then we say, let's have equality, then everyone gets an equal share of that money. And so you might argue that there is no value to equality in that, in its independent nature as a value, that it depends on others for its existence. And so you can argue against the value in that way. Yes?
I'm recalling just from a recent LD topic in high school, which was quality of life or sanctity of life. And one of the major points that was brought up is that life may not actually be a value. Perhaps the preservation of life is a value, but life itself is a prerequisite. And that you can't work to attain life.
Right.
You can only work to preserve life.
And
I always thought it was a pretty good way to take care of that value.
And in fact, you can examine all values this way to be able to argue whether or not it is a value per se, whether there is a value in and of itself. This is the second way in which you can argue it. Essentially, you're creating a value hierarchy, some preferred ranking system, in which you're making the claim that some issues are to be preferred and other ones are secondary or lesser significance or contingent values. The third way in which you can argue against a value is to assume the policy actions that one would take in endorsing a particular value. And so if you accept the issue of liberty and you accept it with consistency toward free speech, this might be a policy that might endorse child pornography. And so there might be some dangers associated with it. Or you might argue that that you have to accept some issues that people oppose in order to guarantee freedom associated with this kind of liberty. And so you would debate about the policy implications associated with it. But this is the second way, I think, in which you can argue about the issue of values. In any case, I think you want to reject singular constructions of values in debates. And the reason why is that there aren't really singular constructions of values. If a government team says, everything in the debate is going to be about the issue of liberty, that's our value. And then they decide that they will establish some way of determining that outcome. Let's have a criterion for the debate that will be cost-benefit analysis. And I'd say that's fairly typical of the way in which many people present their value and criteria claims at the beginning of their presentation. Here's the problem with that. There are multiple expressions of values, and it's impossible to unpack the issues of life and equality and privacy from the idea of liberty. So you have a government presentation in which the government says, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to focus on the issue of liberty. Our value is liberty. And our criterial issues in the debate will focus on cost-benefit analysis. And this is the way in which we should appreciate the debate. Here's what you should do on the opposition. You should identify all the examples in the case that do not match this value, or better match some other value. So they might have an expression of liberty, and they might say the importance of liberty is free speech. And your reply might be, well, free speech is more an expression of privacy. That's the way in which we understand speech in contemporary America, because it's not just about the right to speak, it's also about the right to hear, and sometimes you don't want to listen to what other people say, and so it's a better expression of privacy than it is about the issue of liberty. And you've probably had this experience in debates in which the final speaker in the debate, this is perhaps your experience both from Lincoln Douglas debate for people that had that as a background, or parliamentary debate in which the final speaker says, well, here's what we need to do. We need to weigh all the issues in the debate through our value and criterial issues. Have you ever heard that in a debate? No. This seems to me to be self-defeating and an easy issue to oppose when you are the opposition. Because you can say, all right, on your first stand on the floor, let's weigh everything through their value. Here's how their case doesn't match their value. All of these expressions are better expressions of other values than they are of the one named by the government. And in addition, this confuses the issue as to whether or not they're upholding their value at all. And so it's possible for you to argue about all the values by arguing this about the examples that they offer in their case. In addition, you can argue the criterial issues. And here they say, and I'd say the majority of people now in parliamentary debate use some kind of strict utilitarianism as the way in which they should determine the outcome of the debate. It's all about cost-benefit analysis. It's all about who promotes the larger advantages. It's easy to argue against that. It's easy to argue against the greater good for the greater number. Should we just exterminate populations and share their wealth with the majority population? That matches this kind of criterial argumentation. Would that uphold the value associated with liberty? Perhaps not. Is this a meaningful decision-making issue in and of itself? I think you could argue against that as well. Not only is this a problem because you can identify and argue against it quite easily, but you use multiple decision-making tools. You don't use a single tool to decide an issue. In fact, you make decisions so quickly, in nanoseconds, that you're not even aware of how many issues you immediately resolve when you make a decision. When you make a decision about where to go to eat, you factor in a number of different issues. This, by saying that there's a singular issue here, seems to me to be woefully inadequate. But I think you can argue against values. Second issue.